Welcome to episode 45 of The Grey NATO, a loose discussion of travel, adventure, diving, gear, and most certainly watches. Thanks for listening. I'm, of course, James Stacey, and joining me, as always, is the illustrious Jason Heaton. Jason, you're in NYC this week. How's the city treating you?
It's a mile a minute. I mean, there's just so much going on out here. It's a big watch week, and there's just a lot of events, and, you know, I try to get out here once a year, and it's always worth it, but yeah, kind of craving a little home time now.
For sure. I've no doubt. I mean, just seeing it on Instagram, it seems like you've got multiple things every day. It's like a little mini Basel friend catch up, all packed into
totally,
you know, kind of one run there. And you must have some trips coming up and all that sort of thing. And truth be told, we've had like a kind of a ton of many little things happen in the last month or so that we haven't really gotten to on the show. So today, the show doesn't really have a main topic. We're talking cars, both fast and slow. We're talking tons of watches, some travel, and also we have no sponsor today, but we would like to extend a big thank you to our previous sponsor, Kill Hubris, for their sponsorship of the last two shows. So, you know, we love their shirts. So if you missed the last two shows and you're just hearing about it now, little free plug for them because we are definitely fans. So check them out. And Jason, I don't really even know where to kick it off. I guess we should give away that awesome Okanoskr wallet, eh?
Yeah, I think so. You know, it's interesting. Speaking of Okanoskr, you know, one of our sort of catch-up items is I got to catch up with Chase Fancher, who's the founder of Okanoskr. He was in Minneapolis a week or so ago, and I got to see his new Jackson chronograph, which is a really cool two-register chronograph. But even before that, you know, we've had this modular watch wallet that he kindly customized and sent to us as a giveaway, and we finally did the drawing, and we do have a winner. It is Luke Albert. Luke, your first name is spelled in the French style, so I don't know if it's Luke Albert or if it's Luke Albert, but Luke is from California. His Instagram handle is @LucAlbert, Luke Albert, on Instagram. So give him a tag or give him a call out or a follow. Congrats, Luke. You know, enjoy this great watch wallet. And, you know, we just want to thank everybody who entered. And again, to Chase at Okanoskr for providing just what's a really cool and really generous giveaway this time.
Yeah, I thought it was really sweet of him to offer something and then to go to the extent of customizing it.
Yeah.
Is really cool. And I'm a little jealous that you've gotten to see the Jackson. I think I might get a chance to see it in December. We're still working out those details. You want to just do a little brief on it? I'm sure a lot of people listening have already read about it. But I can go over the specs. You can go over the impressions maybe.
Sure. Yeah.
So you're looking at, it's a manually wound flyback chronograph with a column wheel escapement, a 60 hour power reserve. So it's based on an Eterna caliber 39. 40 millimeter case, it's 14.5 millimeters thick, 20 millimeter lugs. It comes in a few different versions, including a gray and a blue dial. It has these beautiful orange accents. Not much use just describing a watch. If you know how good the designs for Chase's previous watches were, it's just that applied to a chronograph. The hands are really good. Again, the use of color is excellent. The blue one, at least in photographs, is my favorite. Jason, what did you think kind of seeing them in the metal?
Yeah, the blue one was my favorite as well. And, you know, the size is great. You know, the movement is a solid movement. It's so rare to see a flyback hand wound chronograph movement in you know, what's essentially an extremely small, you know, micro brand that Okanoskr is. And so, you know, that aside, just visually, it's just stunning. You know, it's a beautiful watch. Wears really well. I know there were some, you know, there's some talk that maybe it's a little too thick, but, you know, you put it on your wrist and given the lug to lug and the diameter and just kind of the way the strap works with the watch, it wears super well. If it's not sold out by the time the show runs, I'm sure it won't be long because he just killed it. I think he's got a real eye for detail and kind of the way that these different visual elements integrate. So,
and it's a total of 400 watches. So there's 150 in gray with your kind of standard brush steel case, and then in the navy blue in the standard case, and then 100 with the gray dial and a charcoal PVD.
Yeah.
Really, really cool. They're in production, so I guess it's more of a pre-order currently.
Sure.
Which I think is how they've done it previously. And I just think they look really good, and I thought it was a nice bit of synergy as we're giving away the wallet. We can mention the new watch. The timing worked out well. So congrats to Chase on the release, and of course, a big thanks from certainly from Luke, but from Jason and I for the wall.
Yeah,
very cool.
Yeah,
stuff.
Definitely. We'll get that shipped off here shortly. So you've been in kind of car heaven lately. You kind of back to back weeks. You had these kind of two amazing
fast
trips.
Stuff.
Yeah, fast stuff. Really fast stuff. Yeah, tell us about that.
Yeah, I can report that after having a couple of fast cars a couple weeks in a row, my license is still fully intact, which of course is a plus, especially here in Canada. They really don't like speeding where I'm at. But I recently took, you know, as part of the whole transition to going full-time freelance, I'm now doing all of the auto writing for a magazine and website in Vancouver called Nouveau Magazine. So I'm their new editor at large. And basically, it's just to up their car coverage.
Yeah.
And being kind of a luxury lifestyle arts magazine, they're really only focused on the more wild stuff. I'm not going to be writing a lot about Toyota Corollas and things like that. So the first car I had was a McLaren 570S. Tough day, really tough day. So I ended up, basically McLaren was running an event at a racetrack called Area 27, which is in Osoyoos, which is a good 450 kilometers from Vancouver through the mountains. So I got the car in Vancouver, drove to Osoyoos, had a day at this amazing track. It's a huge track. It's over 3 miles long.
Huh.
I think it's 16 or 17 corners. It has elevation change. It has three huge straightaways.
Jeez.
It has a corkscrew. It was great. And essentially had unfettered use of the car once they realized I probably wasn't just going to leave the road at speed.
Yeah.
And so I had an amazing track day, and then the next morning got up before sunrise and blasted back to Vancouver.
Boy, that's a lot of kilometers. I mean, that's a true proper test of a sports
car,
right?
Yeah, probably did over 1,000 kilometers in the car, I'd say,
yeah.
Which is substantial for the McLaren, and it's just an absolutely amazing car, easily the best car I've ever driven.
Wow.
From an overall standpoint of a sports car.
Yeah.
My only complaint would be is that I'm 6'3". No, I don't fit really well in any sports car.
Yeah.
And while I think I fit perfectly in the 570S, even with a helmet, I had room, which is remarkable.
Huh.
But I think I probably should have made more stops on my 5-hour trip.
Oh.
Because certainly the trip home, I kind of just wanted to get home, and I ended up staying in the car for too long, and I had no real way of fully extending either leg.
Huh. Huh.
There just isn't that much leg room. You're right where your feet are right where you want to be on the pedals.
Yeah.
But it's not like the foot box is wide like in other cars where you could kind of get a foot next to the pedals and stretch it all the way out.
Right.
Anyways, so I ended up with a little bit of back pain from that. So I think that's mostly on me. I'm driving, you know, a very capable sports car. So they can't really do everything for you. And then a week later, I flew into Toronto for, oh man, might have been 18 hours, and went to a racetrack called the Canadian Tire Motorsports Park, I believe. It's better known by Canadian as Mosport.
Huh.
And they have a driver development course, which is a much smaller kind of sidetrack. And there we got to do what it maybe turned out to be 6 or 7 laps in the new Lamborghini Aventador S.
Wow. Yeah.
And this is you couldn't have a polar opposite experience from the 570, which was like very smooth and progressive and confidence inspiring. And I mean, both cars are disturbingly fast. The McLaren has 562 horsepower,
yeah,
but it has two turbochargers. And then the Lamborghini has 740 horsepower.
Oh my gosh.
And no turbos.
Wow.
So it's a 6.5 liter V12 that revs to 9,000 RPM.
Wow.
And honestly, I know that like Lamborghinis are their status symbol cars, and really so are McLarens in many ways.
Yeah.
But Lamborghini also has some really trick suspension in this car. They have 4-wheel steering. The car is wild. Like if you've ever been on one of those wooden roller coasters,
yeah.
Intellectually, yeah. You know you're not going to leave the rails.
Yeah.
But everything seems to happen too fast and is much harsher than you expected.
Yeah, yeah.
That's what this car was like. So it has a single clutch transmission. So when you shift, especially when you're talking about shifting fast and hard,
yeah,
it hits so hard. It's such a hard shift.
Huh.
And downshifts are amazing. The sound is unbelievable from that engine.
Yeah.
The car moves all over the road. The little track, this driver development track they had us on, was quite dusty.
Hmm.
And the car has hugely staggered tires. So it's a four-wheel drive car, but the front tires are 255 sections, which aren't huge. That's not huge for a sports car. They're big. And then the back is 355s.
Oh, wow.
Which is the biggest tire I've ever driven, certainly. You know, I've seen 335s on 700 horsepower cars, so this is even wider. It's just so much rubber, and the car is absolutely insane. It makes all the right noises, and if you look at a Lamborghini, especially the Aventador, I think you pretty much know how it drives.
Oh, yeah.
It looks crazy, and it drives crazy. That's pretty much the way it is, and I mean, it's not crazy like scary, but everything it does is so aggressive and so urgent and so eager. The car really wants to go fast. It really wants to dive into corners, huge brakes, like I said, huge amount of tire.
Yeah.
And then you just have all the RPMs you can need. I think I was flat once in second gear.
Wow.
So
wow.
You definitely want a much larger track.
Yeah.
And I can't imagine exploring any part of this car's performance on a normal road, like on a public road. It's just, it's obscenely fast. The McLaren was crazy fast, and this is just a step beyond that. And I've driven some really, really fast cars, and certainly the Aventador puts on speed like the Veyron. I drove a Veyron a few years ago, and obviously there's still a difference in power there. The Veyron is 1,200 horses, but there's also a big difference in weight.
Well, you know, it's interesting. A while ago we talked about, I'm not sure if it was on a show or just offline, but we were talking about how good and fast modern sports cars are, that and the fact that anybody with money can get in one of these things and pilot it, which is the right word for it. I mean, it's almost like you're strapping yourself into like a fighter jet now, and the trouble you can get into very easily just because of the capabilities of the car and the potential lack of capabilities on the part of the driver really mm-hmm. make them kind of a frightening prospect. You had sent me an article that someone else doing the McLaren trip had actually wrecked one of the test cars on the way to the track. I mean, I can see how that happens.
Yeah, it was largely a client event.
Oh, okay.
And so this was a client, and they were the highway basically from Hope to a Soyuz is called the Crow's Nest, and it's this amazing mountain highway.
Yeah.
You know, not quite the mountain passes you see on Top Gear episodes, you know, and such on, you know, but. Yeah. As far as the Canadian driving goes, this is an amazingly smooth piece of road, well-maintained, sees a lot of traffic, and, you know, in the off hours, it's essentially empty. And apparently, yeah, some guys got too deep into the performance potential of that McLaren, which is really easy to do because it you feel very insulated from the speed, and the car is very stable-footed and very progressive in its performance and how it kind of goes a little bit further every time you do something.
Yeah.
And yeah, they crashed, and I think they kind of spun the car like a top in a ditch. They were both fine. They had both went to the hospital with some minor injuries, but the car was just like a shell. It was just carbon and aluminum that was left.
I mean,
everything
else
kind of burned up.
The way you're talking about these two cars, you know, you drove them back to back, and the way you described the Lamborghini is exactly the way I would expect the Lamborghini, you know, this outrageous Italian sports car to be described, mm-hmm. and your McLaren descriptions are much more measured, more sedate, even though I get the sense from you that you, if you were to, you know, have that unlikely scenario where you were able to choose, you'd probably choose the McLaren, right?
Yeah, and certainly the two don't actually exist in the same price point either, surprisingly.
Huh.
So if we go off Canadian dollars,
yeah.
My apologies to everyone else who has to do a little bit of mental math in your head, it's in the range of 30% to the USD.
Yeah.
Or 75%, I guess, if you're going that direction. The McLaren was somewhere around $240,000. And that brings us to not quite half what the Aventador cost.
Okay.
So, I mean, the McLaren 570S, much more comparable to the Huracan,
okay.
which is a more sedate Lamborghini, is my understanding. I've not driven a Huracan.
Yeah.
But when they make the Aventador, I do think that they purposefully go to establish the same sort of thing they had with the Countach, the Diablo, and the Murcielago,
yeah.
which is a much more raw, dramatic, exciting, visceral sort of experience. I don't think that they're designing these things to be like
sure.
coddling and quiet and sedate. And I could literally just barely fit in the Lamborghini with a helmet.
Yeah,
and I actually hurt my neck because I had to drive the fast laps with my head to the side.
Oh, jeez.
And the transitions in the car are so aggressive when you're driving at what is my limit. It's certainly not a capable driver's limit. But when I'm driving to my limit, the transitions, I still found, you know, the pressure it puts on your body is very high. And with the seating position, I kind of just had my tailbone and my shoulder blades touching the seat.
Yeah, yeah.
And then my head kind of to the side. Without a helmet, I fit okay. I mean, it's not a ton of space in that car, and it's a very big car.
Yeah.
Aesthetically, I would prefer probably the McLaren's aesthetic, but I think it's undeniable that the Lamborghini is really a treat to look at. I think it's a wild, really fun design. It's beautiful from quite a few angles.
Huh.
And the price is eye-watering to a normal guy like myself.
So you've got a third high-end car trip coming up here, if I remember right, that Aston Martin, right?
Yeah, at the end of October, I'll be taking a trip to San Diego for, I think it's like one of these 24-hour things.
Oh, yeah.
And that's just to do a one-day drive of the new DB11 V8.
Mm. Yeah.
So that's the new flagship Aston, but with the 4-liter twin turbo V8 from AMG.
Yeah.
So that's kind of a new thing for them. Typically, the flagship Astons, the big ones, have been V12s, Aston V12s. And so now they're going for a V8. And, you know, I saw some reviews. Catchpool has an amazing review, which I'll put in the show notes. And all around, it looks to be like it should be really cool and different in that it's not a supercar or a sports car. It's very much a GT, a sporty GT. So obviously looking forward to that. And then just to round off the car and the trip thing before and to bring us in some way back towards watches, I'm going to go to Formula One in like a week. So it'll be shortly after this episode goes live for Hodinkee with IWC. So that should be really fun too, and I'm going to get it hands-on with a watch. I'm not sure what watch yet, but...
And that's in Austin, Circuit of the Americas, right? Yeah.
Yep. So I think that pretty much rounds it off. I'm not entirely sure how interested in cars the Grenado audience is, but luckily, I think you happen to go into cars roughly at the same time, or a new car, new old car at the same time, that I think fits way closer to the Grenado vibe than a McLaren or a Lamborghini. You've got something new in your driveway. For anyone who doesn't follow you on Instagram, what's the reveal?
Yeah, a couple of weeks ago, I bought a 1976 Land Rover Series 3. And, you know, if you do follow me on Instagram, apologies in advance, because you're going to just see that car, and like every other photo is going to be that vehicle, because I'm entirely smitten with it. It's an entirely impractical, very slow, very uncomfortable truck, and most likely very unreliable as well. But that said, I just adore it. While I'm out here in New York, I'm having some work done. In fact, I just talked to the guy who's doing the work back home, and he did some sort of undercarriage patching and cutting out rusty bits and spraying some rust inhibitor all over it. And I just can't wait to get back to it. I found it on Craigslist in Minneapolis, and it was from a guy who was he's an engineer at Toro, which is, as some people might know, that the tractor company, like lawn tractors and stuff.
Oh, so, sure. Yeah, yeah.
And he did a lot of work to it, which gave me a lot of confidence. If a guy who's worked at Toro for like 34 years as a tractor engineer, you know, owns a Land Rover, it seems somehow fitting. And he'd done, you know, front to back, he'd done new exhaust system and new drive shafts and new, you know, redid all the fluids and put in a new heater valve and et cetera, et cetera. And so mechanically it is pretty sound. I mean, it drips some oil, which, you know, I'm told is normal and almost desirable in these. And, but yeah, it was a little rough body wise, but I think it's going to be sorted by the time I get home. And, it's kind of just the right level of patina for a vehicle for me. I didn't want, you know, a show car. I mean, this thing kind of sits outside, and you know, Minnesota's not too kind to vehicles. So, you know, the price was good. It was cheaper than some watches I own, and just kind of felt like the right moment. I've wanted a Land Rover for a really long time. I just find them, it's kind of like the feeling you get when you put on a dive watch or something. You know, it just has that, you somehow feel empowered, and they're just fun to look at. So, you know, it's originally, I guess it started its life in the UK. It was imported by this guy, this tractor engineer from, he used to travel to England, and he found it over there for sale. And it was doing, just living out its life on an estate in Scotland. So probably just bumping around on country roads and that sort of thing.
Yeah, farm truck.
So yeah, so it's a right-hand drive, four-speed stick shift, incredibly slow. I mean, like I think I saw 42 miles an hour after I got the speedometer working, which it didn't when I first got it. It's rough. I mean, it's a rough ride. It's leaf springs at all four corners, and it's an 88-inch wheelbase. So it's like, you know, you just feel everything. And if you get going at speed, at any speed, which isn't often, and you hit any type of uneven pavement, it starts this sort of bucking bronco sort of effect, and you come out of it feeling just beat up. So, you know, this all doesn't probably sound very appealing to anybody, but it's just a gas. I just feel like a kid when I get in this thing.
It's charm on wheels.
Yeah, it really is. I almost like looking at it more than driving it, but it's fun to kind of bump around. I'm going to get one of those big orange slow vehicle signs for the back, just because I think traffic piles up behind me when I'm double clutching from one gear to the next, you know. So,
well, I was in Memphis when you told me that you had gotten it.
Yeah,
and I was in the car with Nick and Giles from Braymont.
Yeah,
both of whom have owned a number of different Defenders and Land Rovers and such, and they were both thrilled. So I thought that was a pretty fun way to find out.
Yeah, I saw Nick English last night, and we were talking about Land Rovers, and of course he gushes over them, and he was telling the story about how his brother Giles had left his old Series 2 sitting in Nick's garden yard for like several months while he was traveling, and when Nick went to start it up, it just didn't start. He couldn't figure out why, and then Giles came back, and they were kind of looking under the hood, trying to figure out what was wrong, and it realized that a mouse had eaten through the fuel line from the tank to the engine, and you know, you can access all this stuff from like below the seats inside the cabin. So they're looking at this, and they realized it had been chewed through. So they went and got like some packing tape, and they taped up the fuel line, and it fired right up.
Amazing.
Yeah. It's just that kind of vehicle. You know, you don't mind doing that sort of thing. So
yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
And I don't know what else. Well, I guess we talked a lot about the English tour on that last one, but that does kind of lead us into Shifted. You went to the big launch last night.
Yeah.
For Shifted magazine. You want to give people a rundown on how that went, maybe a bit about the magazine?
Yeah, so, you know, it's really cool because both you and I are going to be contributing quite a bit, hopefully, in the future to Shifted. I've got a column, and we're both going to kind of contribute feature pieces. And Shifted's a new venture from the guys at Analog Shift, the vintage watch dealer online. And it's kind of hard to describe the exact vibe they're after, but they were kind of going for, if you can imagine what, say, Esquire or Playboy magazines used to be back in the, you know, everywhere from the 40s up through maybe the 70s, where there was kind of a more literate, long-form feel to them, and they had some fiction and some graphic, you know, like, not cartoons, but, you know, serialized sort of graphic stories, and, you know, bringing in some guest writers and a lot of just, you know, topics that are very relevant to people like us that are into mechanical watches and old cars and that sort of thing. So the concept behind Shifted is a bi-weekly digital publication that is subscription-based. And I think they're charging $19.99 a year for 26 issues, which seems like a pretty good bargain to me. And then they've also got some kind of regular blog content as well that kind of keeps people sated between issues.
Yeah, my piece on the English tour, which has photos and all that kind of stuff, that was for the website side.
Oh yeah, right.
And then I think issue one is the only one that's out so far, which you can get for free.
Yeah.
And it basically just loads into, if you've ever done the digital magazine thing on your phone or your iPad or whatever, the Shifted works kind of just like that. So you're just essentially, you can see the available issues. The first one is free, and then from there, yeah, it's a seemingly very reasonable $20 a year to have access to the others, and they come out every second Saturday.
Yeah. So it just kicked off on 10/10, and then they had a launch party here in New York last night, actually Thursday, and incredible attendance. I mean, there were 400-plus people, and they did it at
Oh, wow.
An old hotel that almost nobody who attended had heard of or been to. It's on the Hudson River, and it has kind of a really sort of old Victorian era sort of feel to it, sort of little dark corners and multiple bars and upstairs and downstairs and a big ballroom. And it was packed shoulder to shoulder. Apparently, this hotel was a place that housed Titanic survivors back in 1912.
No way.
That was kind of an interesting tidbit that I learned. Cool. But yeah, there were just a lot of people there, and they had some live music, and Bulova was a sponsor, and they were giving away a Bulova watch, and it was just just a good rollicking good time, and big congrats to the guys at Analog Shift, and specifically to Jacob Sotak, who mm-hmm. Has kind of masterminded this thing, and hats off to him for the work he's put in, and I'm really excited to contribute, and I know you are. I think it's kind of breathed sort of a breath of fresh air into a lot of the work that we do. I think it'll be really cool.
Yeah, and I know certainly for my side, watches are going to Hodinkee, and now I have cars with Nuvo, which is at Nuvo Mag on Instagram or NuvoMagazine.com if you want to check that out. Every Friday I'll have a piece up for them. And then with Shifted, so far it's been really largely outside of my comfort zone. The piece that I did in the magazine for them was a look at 5 bottles of whiskey that were under, I think, $60.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then they crossed that with another guy's kind of cross-referenced each whiskey with a suggested cigar.
Oh, yeah.
And that's fine. I don't smoke. I don't know word one about cigars. So it's good that they didn't require me to know anything about that. That's excellent. I do have a little bit of experience with some scotch, especially the cheaper stuff. So that's fine.
Yeah.
And then other than that, some of the other stories that are coming up, which I'm in no way going to spoil or talk about before they hit the digital pages of the magazine, are really exciting and stuff I haven't really broken into before. So I'm having a really good time, and I put the magazine on my phone when it came out on the 10th, and have been kind of selectively waking up by reading a couple pieces every morning.
Yeah,
and I've really been enjoying it because it doesn't feel like you're on a website. You can read it on something a bit bigger than your phone. You can do it on your phone if you want, and I'm liking it so far. So there's their plug, and certainly if you want to support Jason and I in some way but don't want to support TGN directly, here's a great outlet.
Yeah.
Support Shifted, and they'll keep us in all the fineries that we're used to, 50-year-old vehicles and
yeah, right.
And that sort of thing.
And cheap scotch, yeah.
Yeah, cheap scotch, and yeah,
cheap old broken down
very
vehicles,
old cars.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, and maybe I'll just mention as well that just even this week in New York, aside from the Shifted launch, I went to a small party that Braymont had for the launch of the 1918 limited edition, which was really fun to see those guys, and got to handle the watches.
What did you think of that in person?
Cool in photos, even cooler in person. I mean, it wears a little tall, but I adore the white gold with that sort of blue and white dial,
mm-hmm.
and then the steel one. But the rose gold isn't kind of my cup of tea, but I was talking to Nick English, and he said I think I want to get a prototype made with like steel case with the blue and white dial, and I was like, that would be right on. I mean, it's a beautiful watch, and I think that tie-in with the RAF, they kind of did it with a light touch. It wasn't heavy-handed. It wasn't roundels or airplanes on the dial. Stuff like that. They incorporated the bits from the historic planes, and if you know those guys, they usually do that kind of thing pretty spot on. So that was cool. And then I just did Friday Live here just before I walked in to record this in the closet here at Hodinkee. I'm actually in a closet in Hodinkee headquarters down here.
There's probably some good stuff in those boxes.
There is. I'm looking around, and this, even the safe is actually open behind me. So I'm gonna have to control myself here. But yeah,
don't put that on the record.
Yeah, right. But yeah, so it's been a fun week. There's a Breitling event tomorrow night. Watch Time New York is tonight. So I'm kind of packing it in, and but it'll be good to be home. Good to get home to a really uncomfortable vehicle and back to the comforts of home, or the discomforts of home, let's put it that way.
Yeah, for sure. Well, I mean, we're now a good 30 minutes into pretty much not a ton of watches, so let's round it out to some watches, because both of us have some kind of new stuff in.
Yeah.
I think you picked up at least a couple things in New York. You want to chat about those? I mean, it's on Friday Live for those that watched, and you did very well. I loved it. So that was cool. But you got two very different dive watches.
I did, yeah. They're both deep divers.
Okay.
But at opposite ends of the spectrum, I picked up the Citizen ProMaster EcoDrive 1000 Meter, which I'll be taking in about a month to Bonaire for some diving. You know, did you get a chance? You didn't have a Citizen appointment at Basel, did you? Did you see this watch in person? It is...
I missed that meeting this year, so I didn't see it. I've just seen the photos.
Somebody commented on a photo I put up, and it said it's like a skateboard wheel on a strap. And the aesthetics are kind of like that. It's about that size. I honestly don't. I should have looked up the specs for this thing, but it is a monster. It's just pure insanity. You know, you don't buy this watch really to do anything other than either dive or... I guess, you know, look like you dive or just kind of just because it's insane. It's really tall. It's got this sort of sawtooth bezel that has a locking device underneath it that you can lock the bezel once you set it. And, you know, despite kind of the cartoonish appearance of this watch, it feels really precision. I used to have one of the old Citizen. I had both the EcoZilla, as they were affectionately known, in the AutoZilla, that kind of automatic 1,000 meter that they used to have. And those were fun watches, but they always kind of felt a little bit, you know, less, you know, like an affordable watch, which they largely were.
Yeah, for sure.
This one, it's kind of a tick up from that. I mean, the bezel really has a nice, just a nice sort of ratchet. I don't know if you can hear that, but it's...
oh, yeah.
It just has a nice, you know, precision feel to it, you know, not unlike a Tudor or something along those lines. The locking mechanism, even though I find it a little superfluous, it clicks into place really nicely. The crown works well. It's a fun watch. Would I own this watch? I don't know, because it probably wouldn't get a lot of wear, but it feels like you're wearing, you know, a dive compass or a depth gauge or something. You know, it just sits so tall.
It looks great, and I think that it definitely fits into that aesthetic established by the AutoZilla and such, but... you know, functionality looks solid. Obviously, if you're requiring a watch with that kind of water resistance, then you're going to have to accept a larger, thicker sort of watch.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
I think it's cool. And do you happen to know the price point or thereabouts?
I think it ticks in just over $1,000. So certainly they make less expensive. I think they still make the EcoZilla, but that's a 300 meter watch. It's mm-hmm. far less expensive. But this one. This one's premium in terms of Citizen dive watch offerings. So,
and for the second one, also a premium option.
Yes, the Sea Dweller, the new Sea Dweller, which, you know, I got to see it at Basel, but haven't handled since then. And I'm doing a press trip with Rolex in a couple of weeks on the 28th. We're going down to the Baja Peninsula in Mexico to do some diving in a place that I've been before, but it's a place called Cabo Pulmo. Rolex, one of their longtime sort of testimonies, I guess they call them, or ambassadors, is a woman named Sylvia Earle, who's a, kind of an icon of environmentalism and oceanography. She was one of the team of the first women aquanauts to live in a habitat during the Tektite project back in the early 70s. Mm-hmm. I think she was the first woman to oversee the National Science Foundation. She's, you know, a National Geographic fellow, et cetera, et cetera. And she's in her 80s. I guess she still dives. So that's part of this trip. And
Sylvia Earle's just amazing.
Yeah.
And for anybody, just to cut in, for anyone who hasn't seen Mission Blue on Netflix.
Oh, yeah.
Like, please be kind and finish this episode of The Greynado.
Yeah.
And then just call in sick to work or leave your desk or whatever and go home and watch Mission Blue. It's really good. And her story is amazing. I'm really excited that you get to meet her.
Yeah.
There were a few people on the boat when I went to Clipperton that had worked with her.
Yeah.
And apparently she is everything you could possibly hope. So that's really cool, and I'm jealous. And what sounds like a great trip. So I think they definitely picked the right guy for it.
Yeah, and she's kind of been known. You see her in pictures diving, at least in the past couple decades. She's always worn a gold Datejust or something. You know, she doesn't really. I've never even seen her in like a Submariner, which is really funny. But yeah, so I've got the Sea Dweller. I literally just picked it up a few hours ago before I walk down here to Hodinkee, and I like it. You know, 43 millimeters it's a nice size watch. You know, we're so used to 40 millimeter Rolex dive watches, except for the Deep Sea, of course.
Right.
But it wears well. The Cyclops is, you know, one of those debatable things that I I can take or leave. I kind of get why they did it. I guess my question about it is, you know, it's a fantastic watch. Rolex makes a wonderful watch, but, you know, was there a need to replace the previous Sea Dweller? I just kind of question. But it's
yeah, SD4K was a great design.
Yeah,
and the only thing I saw it for what you see it for 10 minutes at Basel, something like that. Yeah. And I remember when I put it on, I felt like, okay, well, it's a Rolex, but it feels really strange.
Yeah. Yeah,
because it has all of the sub stuff you're used to.
Yeah,
but then you get the red text, and you're like, oh, almost like your brain kind of goes like, it's old, but then it's big. It's a weird thing that I think. I mean, why not do it?
Yeah,
I don't think they're offending anybody, and it's not like the SD4K was so limited,
right?
That there's a bunch of people out there that had the money to buy one and didn't.
Yeah,
if you want one, you could still find one. It's not really something worth complaining about.
Yeah.
The design aspect is totally the sort of thing that dive watch nerds and watch nerds and Rolex nerds are going to complain about. And I could definitely do without the Cyclops, but that's totally because I always thought it was really cool when I saw a sub and then realized it was a Sea Dweller because it didn't have the Cyclops, but you could see the date.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's just like a weird fascination. I don't think it matters to the product.
Right, right.
And it may not matter to somebody who wants a 43mm dive watch too, when you consider the capability. And this is the point you made back at the Basel one when we were first talked about the watch, was, you know, the capability of the standard no date sub is so high that like the Sea Dweller is largely like a name. It's like the AMG version of a G-Wagon.
Yeah
It's just another level up. It costs a little bit more money. It fills out a range. There's some it probably better competes with some watches that Rolex would like to trade blows with in stores. Guys who already have a sub or five subs and want something bigger.
Yeah.
They want a weekend sub. They want a crazy sub, and maybe they already have a deep sea. Like, you got to think they make so many watches. Some of them are going to be niche, and not all of them are going to be niche towards the enthusiasts that like the last niche.
Yeah. Yeah, I hadn't thought about the competitive aspect of it. You always imagine Rolex as sort of above the fray, and they don't kind of...
And maybe they are, but there's certainly other companies with larger...
But when I think about this, you know, vis-a-vis other brands' watches, I wonder if this kind of almost slots into like a Planet Ocean killer. I mean, like the standard sub-date, you know, it's a 300-meter watch, it's 40 millimeters. A guy who's out there just loving his, you know... 42 or, you know, I guess what, 45mm
45.5, yeah.
Planet Ocean, you know, this might become like, oh, finally Rolex has made one that I can consider because I like my big watch, you know. So maybe I hadn't thought about that. That's an interesting point, yeah.
Yeah, it could be. And obviously a lot of 50 Fathoms watches are 45mm.
Right.
Not all of them, but you know, by in part, the classic design of the 50 Fathoms has been 45mm for some time.
Yeah.
So I think that I see it as more of a competitive move and a way of differentiating a really solid product in the current sub date or no date. And maybe they simply felt that the SD4K was just simply too similar in a great many ways to a no date sub. I don't know.
So you've got a big dive watch. I mean, this is like the big week for big dive watches.
I got some stuff.
Yeah.
I'm having a good watch week.
Yeah.
So first up on wrist right now is a watch that was my most favorite from SIHH this year.
Yeah.
And that's the Panerai PAM 682. It's the 42mm submersible. This is my jam when it comes to an expensive watch.
Oh, yeah.
I really like it. It's going to suck to give it back. Like, from the minute I picked it up, it has an awesome rubber strap, a great dial. The case is really cool. It's just the right size for my wrist. If you have like a 7-inch wrist and you look at I always kind of look at, like, especially the 47mm submersibles, and I kind of look at them like that strange Lamborghini SUV, the LM002.
Oh, right. Yeah.
And I'm like, you never see them. I mean, like, I think I've seen one big submersible in person, and that was on a dude that was hanging out with Schwarzenegger at Basel a few years ago. And I'm like, hey, guess where a submersible looks perfect?
Yeah.
Around Schwarzenegger. Like, that.
Yeah,
I get it.
But yeah,
like,
right.
Anybody who sees me or you can hear my voice, you know I don't look like Arnold Schwarzenegger. Like, I need a smaller watch. But I adore that aesthetic. You know, Panerai, especially their aesthetic was one of the first things that really drew me into watch fascination, because it was connected to diving, but they don't look like dive watches.
Yeah.
And then boom, you see these Luminors with a rotating bezel, and then you have the submersible, and now they have a great movement, like, you know, these in-house 3-day movements. I believe that 3-day system is borrowed from JLC. That's never going to hurt. The only ding I have against this watch is that I can't afford one.
Yeah.
that's literally the only thing. They're $8,600 US.
Huh.
And they're not going to be a big seller.
Yeah.
Would be my prediction. So it's not like we're going to see a flood of them on Watch Recon to bring the price down. I think when they do pop up, they're going to be $7,500 for a long time.
Yeah. Yeah. You put it on a NATO strap. It's kind of the first Panerai in your Instagram photo. It's the first Panerai I've seen that actually looks decent on a NATO strap, actually.
Oh, it's so good on the gray NATO. And to its credit, the rubber strap it comes on...
Oh, it's fantastic.
Yeah. ...is just awesome. It's really good. I've been working all week to try and arrange the ability to dive with it.
Yeah.
I don't know if it's going to happen. We're having beautiful weather here in Vancouver. All of my dive buddies are out of town.
Yeah.
So I may end up going like on a group dive with a shop... And just handing whoever's near me the camera and saying, like, can you just point it roughly at me and just keep taking photos?
Yeah, yeah.
I'll do my very best. I think it might not happen. I have the watch for a little bit longer.
Yeah.
The funny thing is it gets the same reaction from everybody. I took it to our local Red Bar group.
Yeah.
And sitting on a table, people look at it and they go, oh, it's a sub. And then they pick it up because subs are, I think, inherently interesting. I think they're very cool. Maybe not everybody finds them beautiful.
Yeah.
I think they're a really cool design. You pick it up and then you realize, like, whoa, something's off.
Yeah.
It's itty bitty. And then you put it on wrist and everybody does the same thing. They kind of lean back like, oh, this is good.
I know.
And it really is. It's an absolute charmer on wrist. And like, I'm going to have to find a way I'm writing my piece for Hodinkee on it now, and I have to temper how much I'm loving the watch. You know, I think it could do with minute markings if I was really picky, but I also couldn't care less that they're not there.
Yeah.
The date's very usable. It has, you know, the normal time setting is that jump hour.
Oh, right.
Which is awesome. I really like that in the few watches that do it. It's great when you just want to get the hour hand out of the way for Instagram. It's like the best because you're not changing the, like, you're not, so like, every day, any time that it's 10 minutes past, it can be 10:10.
That's true. Yeah, I hadn't thought about that. Yeah.
Super handy. The bezel's great. This is what it sounds like. It's like chunky and super mechanical. It's only 60 clicks and they're like perfectly defined.
Yeah.
It's beautifully finished. It has great lume. I love the bit of blue on the sub-seconds.
Yeah.
I could rave for this watch for a long time, so I'm just going to cut myself off. If you get a chance, if you're in a town that has a good Panerai store or a Panerai retailer, please swing in and take a look at this watch. Just try it on your wrist. Even if you kind of go like, you know what, I hate Panerai, I don't like them, they're all too big. I'm with you, they are too big, and they're difficult to wear, and this one is the most difficult to wear design in the most wearable size.
Yeah, I agree.
I could definitely see some people saying like, oh, 42 is still too big for my wrist, because it's very chunky. But the lugs sit on the lower side of the case, so it really keeps the watch against your wrist.
Yeah.
And I found it to be very wearable. And, I mean, whether I'm walking around and it's raining and I'm wearing a Patagonia Puffy or a rain jacket, it looks awesome. If you're wearing, you know, jeans and a t-shirt, it works. It just kind of gets it. This watch kind of gets me. It's cool. It's one of the few, like, expensive, genuinely expensive watches, a watch that I think that anyone could claim. It's a lot of money. It's over 10 grand Canadian.
Yeah.
That I would genuinely like, if I had the ability, I would definitely have one in my collection. I think it's mega.
They don't, they just don't look like anything else either. You know, I mean, okay, unless there's especially watches that try to look like subs. Them. Yeah. They're almost, you know, steampunk is a term that's overused with regard to Panerai, but they
do look like a little submarine though.
They do. Yeah. And even like, does this one have like the little, look like little nail heads for the minute markers around the bezel? And like, it's so... You're right. It's so mechanical. It looks like someone sort of cobbled it together in their garage in a very good way. You know.
And then have you ever messed with, because you had a sub not too long ago.
Yeah, it was the 305. So it was the 47mm titanium one. I loved it.
Did it have traditional like lug bars? Do you remember?
Yeah, it did.
This one has like this trick locking lug.
Oh, no.
And I know that there's going to be a few guys listening that are like, Panaristi dudes that are just yelling like you're an idiot. They've had this for a while. I genuinely don't have a huge amount of experience with Panerais, and the last two or three that I had used normal spring bars.
Yeah.
This one, on the back of the lug, on one side, there's a little button that you press with a pusher with a tool, and then it unlocks a spring bar.
I think that sounds familiar. Maybe mine did have that. Maybe we're both idiots. I don't know.
It uses like a solid rod that has a little indentation that clicks into a lock. So there's no way to scratch the case unless you are five scotches in when you decide to show this to your buddy.
Yeah, yeah.
It's like you use one little, you know, straight pin pusher to push the button and one just to gently touch the spring bar, and it's free. It's so good. I love it. It's great.
Wow.
So much more sturdy than a normal spring bar, especially with a watch of this value that you might actually want to take into the swimming pool.
Sure.
Into the ocean. You know, I think this is kind of an adventurous watch. Sure, it's on the expensive side, but it's at $8,600. It's what, within $500-$600 of the price of a Sub C?
Yeah, right.
So I think that a guy that would buy a Sub C as his daily wearer might also fancy something like this as his weekend watch.
And it's just the opposite aesthetic. It's so
for sure.
You want to wear it on rubber, you want to wear it on leather.
Yeah.
Just fun.
I have yet to find a strap that it doesn't work on. And for those of you who have no idea what I'm talking about for the lug release, the spring bar lug release, I'll find a video on YouTube that shows how it works.
Yeah.
And I'll put it in. So those of you who are like me and haven't really played around with removing the straps, this is definitely the product of Panerai knowing that people love to change the straps on their watches.
Oh, yeah.
And are tired of either scratching the lug or digging a screwdriver into like some $800 leather strap you bought.
Yeah.
This prevents both. It's really clever.
So you have another watch that I would say is almost the polar opposite that you're wearing.
A good pal of mine from our local Red Bar YVR group is at Aged Patina. And his name is Greg, and Greg was kind enough, you know, he's the Speedmaster guy. He's the guy I know for all the Speedmaster stuff, and he's a fantastic collector. He has some really cool old Breitlings. I had a Chronomatic that's signed Burks on my Instagram feed a couple times. That's his. It's crazy. Whenever I go to Red Bar, it's invariably a couple of the coolest stuff that I get to see and put on Instagram is Greg's. So follow.
Yeah, he's got a great feed. Yeah.
Yeah. Follow at Aged Patina. Anyways, he was kind enough just because I have some experience with Speedmasters. You know, I've borrowed a couple from Omega. I've obviously had many on and you know, went to that NASA event a couple years ago where you essentially saw every Speedmaster that ever existed. But I didn't have a lot of experience with like actually wearing an old one. And so I was kind of just chatting with him about it, and he offered to loan me his 1971. It's a Cal 861, so it's a, for you speedy guys, it's a 145.022.
Sure.
So it has a step dial, but the painted logo, and I've been wearing it off and on for a while, and I may not be in line to buy a new speedy, but I'm definitely on board with an old one. These are really cool. This is like the difference between a new Alfa Romeo and an old one.
Yeah.
The old ones are just full of charm, and there's much more alluring to me. So a huge thank you to, again, Greg at Age Patina.
It's so weird about the new versus old, because they're almost identical. There's something about them, and I can't put my finger on it. I think it's the dial or something. I don't know what it is.
This one's got what he calls his lawnmower bezel. The bezel's destroyed.
Oh, yeah. They look good with the
buzzed-out
bezels.
Yeah, and I promptly put a scratch on the crystal.
Oh, gee.
So we'll have to polish that. It's a Hezolite crystal, and then the hands are all... It just has a really nice... True to the name of his Instagram, has a really nice development of patina.
Yeah.
And these are mega. These are really cool. If you haven't had time or the chance to check out old Speedy, don't make the mistake of just assuming they're the same or they're going to wear the same as a new one, because I've had a handful of 3570s and all that kind of stuff before, and never really connected with it at a level where I would want one. And this on a NATO or on a leather strap, it's killer. So a huge thank you to at H Patina. All of you should follow Greg. Lots of cool stuff and some stuff that you're not going to see other places, like the old Breitlings, especially the Burke sign stuff. So if you like the vintage, go that way.
Well, I think they're going to start getting nervous if I stay in the closet too much longer here at Hodinkee.
Yeah, so, for sure.
Should we jump into some final notes? Yeah.
Yeah, let's do it. That works for me.
Yeah, what have you got? I've only got one today, so why don't you take the lead here?
So we already mentioned Mission Blue, so let's throw that out there. It'll be in the show notes. Everybody should know who Sylvia Earle is, so do that. I can buzz through mine really quickly, so that's fine. First one is a camera strap. For a long time, I've been using this orange Gear Patrol Dispatch camera strap that you gave me and really enjoying it. But I was finding that I was washing it with some frequency because the orange just picks up sweat.
Yeah.
And all that kind of thing. And I wanted a backup, and especially one, something that would give me maybe more than one way of mounting it to the camera.
Sure.
So after digging around for a little bit, I ended up picking up the Peak Design Slide Light.
Huh.
One of the Red Bar guys, Norm, had the same camera or the same strap on a Fuji camera that's roughly the same size as my 6500. And in person, it just looks really, really good. And I know you've had some experience with their straps before.
Yeah.
And there's not a lot to say. I'll throw it in the show notes. It's a really high-end camera strap that can be worn as a traditional chest strap or as a sling, depending on where you put these little mounts. And then the anchor system kind of pops in or out really quite easily but securely from the strap itself. And then finally, if you want to change how far the camera hangs, it has this really trick, like levered sliding keeper.
Yeah, so cool.
So I found that, you know, if I'm getting in and out of a car, like I will when I do the car stuff, I like the camera a little higher so that it's not interfering with a seatbelt or swinging and hitting a door or a window of a very expensive car, something like that.
Sure.
And if I'm walking around and I want the camera kind of under my arm or under my arm and under a jacket, like it's raining, then you can back the strap way off and have a bunch more strap, and it works like a sling strap, very similar to, you know, the sort of thing you had with the Black Rapid, which is one I used for a long time, but of course could really only be worn as a sling.
Sure. And it looks like the Slide Light is essentially the same as the Slide. It's just that they sized it down for the smaller cameras like your 6500. So it's
exactly.
Is it slimmer? Is the strap itself
narrower? Yeah, I think the width of the webbing used on the strap is narrower.
Sure.
And things like the actual hardware is sized for that, so it's just a less beefy version than the one that they make for the DSLRs.
Sure. Cool.
Kudos to Peak Design for making yet another kind of cool product. I know we've chatted about a handful of their stuff before, and their clips are super famous, and I think that they've done some really nice work with the camera strap. I would definitely buy another one, and it'll probably make its way into at least one or two gifts this Christmas.
Well, I've only got one today. I'll just jump in with mine. You know, we talked about Shifted earlier, and I don't know, there's this revolution, it seems, with magazines nowadays kind of being almost luxury products. Like really, even though they say the print industry is sort of declining, I find that there's some really exciting magazine titles out there. And one,
for sure,
that I've really warmed up to lately, kind of discovered a little while back, is Sidetracked. It's published out of the UK, and I believe it's quarterly, I think, and they also have a fairly nice website that reproduces some of the content from the magazines, but not all of it. And you know what's great about it is it's adventure writing in long form, not too long that, you know, it's not 5,000 word articles one after the other, but it's a lot of content. It's a lot of fairly long stories about everything. The issue I read on the flight out here had something about the first ascent of a canyon in Taiwan. There was something about mountain biking in Lebanon. There was a climbing piece. There was something about free diving. And it's kind of all the stuff we like to read about in a very sort of unpretentious way. You know, a lot of these, it's big name guys and lots of, gear sponsorships, et cetera. Mm-hmm. And these are just kind of a very literate way of describing just some kind of otherwise unknown adventurous, exploits made by people. And there's very little advertising. The advertising's actually at the very beginning and then at the very end, and there's none in the middle of the magazine. And the photography, the director of photography for the magazine is a guy named Martin Hartley, and you can look him up on Instagram. He's kind of a well-known British polar photographer. He kind of focuses a lot on Arctic stuff. He's done stuff with Ben Saunders, and in this issue I was reading, he did a nice portrait of Ranulph Fiennes. So, you know, the photography's top notch and it's printed on some nice paper and, just nice. So if you're looking for a new magazine to check out, other than Shifted, take a look at Sidetracked. Really, really cool.
So. Yeah. I added that to, my Christmas gift list for my folks. I thought it looked really good from your suggestion, and I swung by their website. The website's gorgeous, so I imagine the magazine won't let me down, and I quickly stopped kind of looking or reading. I like to be surprised by what's in the magazine. I've had a blast reading, like I said, both Shifted and the first issue of Hodinkee magazine, so really getting back into enjoying that kind of stuff. It's I'm really happy to see it kind of happening. And certainly it's nice to see it happen within the a few different realms that we're interested in, watches, and certainly the Hodaki Mag has some car stuff, and then Shifted has all the great stuff. It's awesome.
Yeah. And soon there will be a Grey NATO magazine.
Oh yes. Yeah, yeah. That's definitely what we need. Exactly. No, no, no.
No, 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 no.
Podcast for now. That's what we're promising. A podcast every 2 weeks.
Yeah, yeah.
So I have one more, but what I actually put on our final notes is nothing more than Decoy. The actual one of my pick is a piece from the New York Times that features you.
Oh, jeez, that is a decoy.
Sneaky. I knew that you wouldn't want me to talk about it or us to point a big light on this, but Alex Williams, the illustrious Alex Williams of the New York Times, who you've gotten to know over the last little while, he did a great piece in sort of a Q&A about dive watches with you called "Does Anyone Actually Go Diving with a Dive Watch?" And of course, Jason, in your case, you do, and I've been known to a couple times, and I thought it was just really exciting to see it, and true to your nature, you didn't tell anybody. You and I chat pretty much all day, most days, and you didn't mention that you were chatting with the New York Times, which is kind of a thing, right? So this is what you get for not mentioning it. I have to sneak it into final notes, but it'll be in the show notes. It's a really great piece of coverage. Obviously, some awesome photos from Gishani, and I thought it was really cool that Alex is kind of continuing to explore the outer reaches, niche applications of watches, and I like that he definitely picked the right guy for that piece. You do dive with all these watches, and you've definitely had some amazing watches underwater. So congratulations on the coverage. I thought it turned out really well.
Well, I appreciate it. I mean, it's, I've bumped into so many people out here in New York, and people bring it up and congratulate me on it. And it's a tough thing to respond to. I'm very, very proud to be in there, and it was really fun to talk to Alex, and the response has been amazing. And, just, it's so great when I guess somebody takes interest in your nerdy little hobbies, and those are my two. So it was a lot of fun. So thanks a lot, you sneaky bastard.
yeah. I knew I couldn't just be like, oh, we're also going to, I'm going to leave this in the show notes. I figured you'd say something.
delete it while we were talking
or something. So
And as always, thanks so much for listening. Hit the show notes for more details. You can follow us on Instagram. I'm at Jason Heaton. And James is at J.E. Stacy. And follow the show at The Grey NATO. If you have any questions for us, please write to thegreynato@gmail.com. Please subscribe and review wherever you find your podcasts. Music throughout is Siesta by Jazzar via the Free Music Archive.
And we'll leave you with this quote from Dr. Sylvia Earle, who said, "I find the lure of the unknown irresistible." And we leave you with this quote from Dr. Sylvia Earle, who said, "I find the lure of the unknown irresistible." And to close, we'll leave you with this quote from Dr. Sylvia Earle, who said, "I find the lure of the unknown irresistible."